Well, thank you all for being here. And first, I want to thank Commissioner Chopra for coming and agreeing to do this. We figured we would solve all of the debated antitrust issues in the first 20 minutes and then leave some question time for you guys. But I especially am grateful that Rohit is here because he's been a great friend to the law school. I bet some of you will not know unless you follow our Twitter feeds that Commissioner Chopra has come to guest lecture classes here on numerous occasions and is always a student favorite. So thank you for the return visit. I thought what we would do is sort of start general commission business and sort of move from there. And so I thought we would start, particularly in today's sort of new antitrust landscape, with your vision. CEA, White House put out a new report today, sort of giving their view of what's going on in the economy and how it should affect antitrust enforcement and the like. It doesn't quite read like the 2016 report, a little bit different. But from your seat inside the commission, thinking about how the FTC should be spending its resources, what's the antitrust enforcement mission look like or should look like for the FTC from your seat?
Yeah, it's a great question. And Evan, thanks to you and the students for having me. I guess let me start by saying where my eyes are on it, which is when I came to the FTC, my entry point was very much a set of experiences that was cleaning up the FTC's mess. I was at the CFPB, and many questions that arose were, where was the FTC during that non-bank mortgage crisis? When I was at the Education Department, and there was massive fraud in several major universities, there was a question of where was the FTC? And so I came to this thinking, there's a lot of data, and there's a lot of trends, and a lot of evidence and insights that sometimes regulators miss, and the results are catastrophic. So I try to approach this with very much, are we using the data and analysis and the quality of analytical rigor that is getting us to the answers of what's really happening in the marketplace? And what I find so far is a lot of missing insights and analysis. And I'll give you an example. The approach to antitrust today is very, very poor at assessing whether transactions or conduct will deter entry. Even though we know for the past 40 years, new firm formation in our economy is going down and down and down. And guess what? That's a big, big problem. So for me, I think we need to look in the mirror. And instead of saying, look how great we are, we should be saying, you know what? The world is getting more complicated. Capital markets are changing. The way firms are behaving is different than it was a generation ago. And we've got to update our tools, the sets of data we look at, so that we can be credible when it comes to enforcing the law and getting that balance right. So I hope that while we're going through this period of flux and a breakdown of consensus, that we look hard about how we can use our tools and really investigate and collect information and data so that we can be evidence-based in our approach. Because often what I feel is it's a know-it-when-I-see-it enforcement approach. You know, I don't like this kind of activity. Let's take all the money. You know, they're a legitimate business. Slap them with a no-money order. This isn't how enforcement should work in any landscape. And I think that's the North Star, is being credible with how you are being rigorous in your investigations.
I want to come back to the a conversation we've had a lot, not on a microphone, is about deterrence and money. And so I want to come back to that in a second. But the economist in me, when I hear let's get more rigor in our investigations and enforcement approach, sort of perks up and says, let's hire more economists. I'm not sure if that's what you mean. So is that what you mean? And if we're talking about, let me bundle two things to let you and let you riff on it. Increase in rigor, are we talking about more economists in the building, who I generally think of as the supply of analytical sort of inputs in the building. Are we talking about, there's been lots of discussion about adding technologists and the like, or are you talking about something different? First part of the question. And then the second is, we got a budget problem, right? Is in terms of resource allocation and priorities for the agency, lots of things to do, adding rigor is costly, lots of different objectives to hit. Give me a little bit about resource allocation at the agency.
Yeah, sure. So I guess I'd say this. You know, economists don't have a monopoly on analytical rigor. Actually, they provide a set of tools that is, you know, can give us more insight as to what might happen. But remember what we're trying to do here. A little bit of the exercise is trying to predict the future, which is really, really hard. And so you have to use a whole set of tools. And that might mean people who have expertise in capital markets. Look at what the UK Competition and Markets Authority is doing with their remedies group. They have people who have lots of financial analytical experience. And even in our Bureau of Economics, we have those financial analysts. So I think it is trying to update all of the types of quantitative and qualitative analysis that give us a full view, you know, and rather than being too narrow in our approach, because here's one of the challenges where I hope the economists also look themselves in the mirror and reflect, you know, how did we miss the mortgage crisis? How did we miss some of the signs about the economic harm from the opioid crisis? These were missed. So we have, that should mean, one, let's update to figure out why we missed it, and two, not think that we have all the answers. So the regulatory humility of, one, knowing what maybe you don't know, and two, maybe thinking a little bit about, do we want to get in the business of micromanaging firms, or do we want to know the whole market structure that, so that we can create the playing field that competition can yield a lot of its benefits. Now, when it comes to resources, I think I am not someone who likes to whine and moan about resources, because I want to use every single talented individual and dollar as best as I possibly can. And that means saying no. We do a lot of small-time scam cases, which many attorneys general can do, many DAs can do. We got to think about, do we want to allocate so much time for things that other enforcers could do? And maybe that needs to be moved. So, of course, you're never going to hear an enforcer saying, I don't need more people, I don't need more money. But if we can be more analytical in our approach about how we prioritize, we can know that we're firing harder on our cylinders.
I think this is probably a good place to do, at least to dip our toes into the deterrence discussion. Because part of your, I think there are like a dozen statements in which you talk about deterrence and money right now, and whether the approach we're doing is right or wrong, what the agency is doing is right or wrong, and the targeting of large versus small firms. Are we getting the bang for the buck that the agency should be from a deterrence perspective? Has a lot to do with this resource allocation question. And I know you've got fairly strong views about misallocating resources, especially this is more on the BCP side, I think. But you want to talk about that for a little bit?
Well, sure. I mean, one of the things that I get really worried about is when we spend a lot of time and energy and land with a result that is actually worse than doing nothing at all. So one of the examples that was very recent, we caught a pretty sizable company, a cosmetics company called Sunday Riley. And this cosmetics company had its CEO give instructions to its employees about how to falsify reviews on a major cosmetic site. And that's illegal. No one's in disagreement about that. But our settlement involved no money, no notice to the consumers. I mean, basically nothing. It was an order that says, you know, go ahead, follow the law next time. And I think the challenge is there's a plethora of insight and data about how fake reviews allow a company
to increase their sales and get a leg over their competitors. So for me, I want us to choose cases that help clarify what the law is and send a very clear signal that if you steal from people, you got to pay it back. And that's what I'm worried about. I'm worried that sometimes we go in with a mindset of often strong-arming small guys into settlements, but when it comes to larger firms, you know, we say, you know, we'll just settle it for zero. And I don't think that's a good use of resources, and it does nothing to deter others, in my view. And I hear this argument, oh, you know, they're going to have an FTC press release, you know, saying they're bad. There's no measurement of what the impact of that is. It's just pure speculation. Know it when I see it. So I think that that is part of the resources. I would much rather see us focus our energy on larger firms that are engaged in harming people nationwide. And maybe they're going to be more likely to litigate, but that's not a bad thing. Doing fewer cases, but that have the legitimacy of a lot of due process, I think is good government. So, you know, look, there's always room for settlements. You know, we need to do them, but we also can do better when it comes to choosing cases and resolving cases. That's a key pivot we need to make.
In terms of litigating more of those cases on the margin?
Litigating more, and sometimes that's going to mean we're going to need to push for money when we know it was obviously illegal. They obviously profited from it, because when we don't do that, I mean, look at we had this settlement last year against YouTube, and the evidence was pretty clear to me about how much they earned based on a sample set, and the amount of our penalty, I mean, it's almost like it's not a penalty, it's an incentive. If you can make money by violating the law, this is not going to do anything. So we have to recalibrate, and when Congress tells us that we're supposed to seek penalties, that means penalties above their illegal earnings. It's supposed to be punitive. Congress told us that, and when we tell them, no, you know, we're just gonna settle for an amount. We're actually not even gonna open negotiations for an amount that is punitive. We're gonna actually open it at less than that. You know, this is a problem.
I will lose my moderator question interviewer privilege if I do not now ask you about
Please.
The Facebook settlement. So $5 billion, where I come from, is a lot of money. You criticized, and others have criticized fairly broadly, the agency. I'm less interested in asking about the number, but talk about the number all you want. I thought the most interesting part of the exchanges and the statements with the between the commissioners on this was about methodology in rigor, to take your word there, on the calculation of the fine. There are lots of interesting statements about, I think yours in particular probably had the most detail about how and where you would come up with the number. Subsequent to the statements, there's been a little bit of, in the way of speeches talking about whether there was any there on the majority's analysis. Mm-hmm. But I'm a little bit less interested in $5 billion is too high or too low than your thoughts on where these numbers are coming from in the process, if that's a bug or a feature of what's going on in terms of enforcement at the moment.
Well, I tried to be pretty clear about this, that this was a headline-driven settlement, and I think it had the, you know, for some it had the impact, wow, that sounds like a lot of money. That's not what I was focused on. For me, money is about the ill-gotten gains you stole, you know, any consumer harm that you might have, you know, pickpocketed from someone. And then on top of that, if it's a penalty action above and beyond, is what will deter it. But here's really what has come out since then. What we heard was that this $5 billion penalty, the justification from my colleagues was that it was way, way more than what we could have gotten in court. Now, let me ask you this. Why would they have agreed to it then? Did they agree to it because Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg weren't subject to a deposition? Did they agree to it because
there was a unprecedented release of claims for Mr. Zuckerberg, Ms. Sandberg, and every executive and board member. And maybe they also paid for a release of claims of known and unknown violations. See, this is the issue. When, and this should be, no matter what you, where you are in the political spectrum, when government is engaging in these kind of business deals where you have no idea really what the transparency is, and we see there's a lot of criticism across the spectrum about settlement transparency, and it's something we need to do much better at, because that $5 billion number, yep, it might, a couple news cycles might do something, but when we did not fully complete the investigation, including an assessment of the role of Mark Zuckerberg, we didn't finish it. So we cut it off, and you know, there was a press conference. And I just think that's fundamentally wrong.
Let me ask you a little bit. We've talked about a lot of dissents, which we are both fond of.
Which, by the way, the seat, Professor Wright is my predecessor for my seat, but throughout history, the seat that we have occupied, no matter what party it has been, there is a tradition of being pretty clear-eyed with your views and how you look at things. And I think there are a lot of deficiencies of a multi-member commission, but I think they want us to be clear about how we assessed certain regulatory actions.
We both learned it from Commissioner Rush, who had the seat before us. I had one of my RAs look up the number of dissents from this seat between Tom, you, and I, and it outranks essentially any other trio of commissioners across the agency history, although I think you are now well ahead of me in terms of the total number of dissents. And in fact, I had a number, but you put another one out this morning, so you tricked me. You got snuck another one in, and we'll talk about the UMC statement in there in a little bit. But let's talk a little bit about, I've got a series of questions I think I want to ask about dissents in general, the role of a minority commissioner in the sort of current
yeah.
landscape, interactions with colleagues in that role, and the value of those dissents. My first dissent was 3 days into the job, and it was a small HSR role. And then Chairman Leibowitz said, "Josh, are you sure this is how you want to start?" And I was pretty sure it is, and went off and started writing dissent. Judge may not remember this, but shortly, about a week into the job, Judge Ginsburg said, I had then had like three dissents. And Judge Ginsburg, we were talking about something else, and said to me, "Josh, you know, a dissent is an admission you couldn't persuade any of your colleagues, right?" And I took that to heart, but kept writing them. But most of what I wanted to do in these dissents is, at least most of them, was start a discussion on some issue that I think thought needed to be outed in some
yeah.
way. Sometimes in cases you've got a little bit more in the part three sense, it might be to write a template for a court of appeal opinion. But sort of generally, how are you thinking about when you dissent versus when you don't? You tend to be much more making your statements through dissents than speeches, right? It's sort of through the written work product. But how are you thinking about what you're trying to accomplish in the dissents, when you decide to do it versus not? And I'll sort of spin that off into some questions
yeah.
about interactions with your colleagues.
Yeah, so I think there was a time at the FTC where there was a lot of consensus building. The FTC used to meet very frequently. Some commissions met weekly. There was actually a lot of engagement with the commissioners early in the case process. I think that's been gone for a while, and I think now it's the cases come up, and then essentially commissioners kind of get their up or down vote on it. So when there is early engagement, you are able to shape some of the key issues, both legal and policy. And you know you won't win everything, but you go along with it because you feel like you had a little bit of impact, and you're one of five, and there's a lot of compromise. But when the cake is baked, then your role is different. Then your role is really to assess it, you know, and to discharge your duty to the public by saying, "This is how I analyze it, And I write statements when I agree. I frequently do it when I agree. I do it when I disagree too, because I do think that is the role. If it's not part of being involved early in the process to shape it, then our duty to the public and to Congress is really to explain our work and explain our assessment of the data and the evidence. So, you know, I really think statements play a critical role. I mean, your statement that you drafted around the use of Section 5 obviously had a huge impact. I have tried to use statements to surface fallow and unused authorities of the FTC, whether it's our, you know, Made in USA rulemaking, to our unfair methods of competition rulemaking, to other key issues that I care about and want to see the agency vigorously use. I also feel I have to defend this agency as well, because people are seeing an agency that many think it's not working. And so they need to know that it's not a bunch of rubber stamping that goes on, but that there's a real debate inside. Because when they know that there's a real debate inside, they think, well, let's figure out how we can contribute to the hearings, to the comments, and shape its direction rather than saying, you know what, let's just start a whole new one.
In terms of general level of engagement, I mean, sort of you described the lack of meeting. I think that sounds like obviously one thing you would change in terms of the big promise of the collegial body is collegiality, right? It's that.
And it is collegial. I mean, everyone, the conversations about policy and law are really based in true trust and friendship. But I think it's not a deliberative body,
right,
in the way that maybe it was back in the day.
So are there things you would change in the process, sort of meeting outside? I mean, you've got... you talked about general lament that maybe the agency isn't carrying its weight, and it comes from both sides of the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a couple of senators, Republican senators, who have, with different rationales, sort of proposed limiting FTC authority or express, you know, some displeasure with what the FTC is doing. So you have this sort of everywhere. Are there other things outside of the meetings, in terms of the interaction and the deliberative process among commissioners, that you would change to sort of improve the agency's production function?
Well, to be fair, I'm not saying that it makes us less productive or more productive. It just changes the role,
mm-hmm,
of the commissioners. So, you know, I do think, and I helped start the CFPB, I would never want it to be a commission. Because it is much more productive because of that, and it's a clear sense of accountability of who is actually on the hook for those decisions. But we have a commission. And so I think one of the ways we really need to push forward is, I think we have a long-lasting impact when the commission can develop policy statements, rules, guides, all the things that matter when it comes to legal interpretation and signaling to the market our future direction. I think there are places when you can come together. Those things are really durable. I mean, we saw many years ago the Department of Justice put its Section 2 report out. It got immediately rescinded when there was a change in leadership. Those durable statements and policy initiatives that are really firmly backed by a rich set of evidence and real consultation, I think that's a place where we really want all of the commissioners to kind of contribute to that, and I really love that stuff.
So one of the, sort of along the same lines, I'm going to ask you about some guidelines after that. Along those lines, one of the sort of promises of a diverse body of commissioners, sort of diverse across experiences and educational backgrounds, et cetera, is you put together five people with different backgrounds and expertise, you know, also, but when I was lawyers and economists and what have you, I think if you were to Google or use the search engine of your choice, criticisms of Commissioner Chopra at the FTC, say, the guy's neither a lawyer nor an economist. What is he doing on the FTC? This is something we've
mm-hmm.
talked about a little bit. And I loved your answer, so I just want to ask you in front of people. What are you doing on the FTC?
Yeah, well, it's funny. I I never before this had this hierarchy of skills and professions, and I just generally think humans should not define themselves by their degrees. And that being said, I do feel one of the things that I'm really hoping to contribute and have been really glad at the success I'm having is bringing more of a realistic sense of how are financial markets shaping firm behavior, and how are firms operating in reality, not in the ivory tower textbook. And I think that's a place where we have a lot we can do, because our current approaches to investigating, our current approaches to economic modeling, they don't account for some of the new forms of ownership, whether it be venture capital investment in terms of firm formation, or private equity roll-ups, or all of the things that have been key features of the economy for the past 25 years. And I don't think it's really been incorporated to our analysis, and I'm seeing such great strides so far, but we have so much more to do. So you know what, I kind of don't care if people think you need to be an economist or a lawyer to sit on the FTC, because I think that diversity of perspectives and backgrounds is exactly, it's a strength, you know, not a weakness.
Let me, I think we're running out of our time, so I'm going to give you dealer's choice on the last one. I wanted to ask you about guidelines. We have a bunch of different ones to choose from. The agency is cranking them out.
So we've got proposed vertical merger guidelines. You cited
my favorite UMC statement this morning in a dissent. We can talk about your views on the vertical merger guidelines, how great a job the UMC statement is doing, or there's been an announced set, and maybe you can't talk much about this, but there's been an announced set or intention to do guidance on platforms, right? So maybe a little bit on what you see the role of guidelines generally, but if you want to pick one to use as an example and talk about, that'd be great.
So I'm generally err on the side of wanting to provide a lot more information to the market about how we apply our law than less. I think certainty is good. People might not like the answer, but they kind of want to know what the rules are. For the vertical merger guidelines, I really feel that so many of us, you know, when I worked at McKinsey, I felt like part of my job was to sort of tell people how you vertically integrate to block out competitors and how you can raise prices. So for me, that's just hardwired into how any smart business person thinks. And that has to be reflected in really what's the deal rationale for a vertical merger, and what are the ways we can determine what those anti-competitive effects are. How is it going to deter entry? How is it going to lead to potentially less choice and options for consumers? How might it distort the behavior of other competitors? All of those things, I think, may not be fully reflected in today's guidelines. And I think over the long term, we will need to make sure that it looks and feels like something that reflects today's economy, not the economy of yesteryear. Now, on the issue of Section 5, so Professor Wright has mentioned the 2015 policy statement on the use of what we call standalone Section 5 claims. That policy statement is still in effect. You mentioned this morning we had a case where it was actually a private equity managing partner. He actually controlled a big rent-to-own chain, was also simultaneously on the board of a top competitor. And under the statement that your commission had adopted, I felt that set of facts using those criteria would mean that the commission should charge that as unlawful, and felt that doing so would have actually provided more clarity to the market about interlocks on boards. And I think that would have been a contribution, and we missed the boat on that. I have also written about the FTC's unused Section 5 rulemaking authority to define unfair methods of competition, and laid out a set of criteria of when we might use it. When we have a lot of enforcement experience, maybe when it's unlikely to have private litigation, I enumerate that. And I think that's a key place where if the FTC is going to last over the long term, Congress has to see us use all these tools, and we can debate about how to use them, but those tools exist. We just last week used our Section 6B authority to order Google, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft to hand over 10 years of deal data on acquisitions that may not have been reportable under the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act. So I really think that Section 5 guidance, it has not been rescinded. It's still there. It's what the staff should be operating under. It's hard for staff to execute the commission's direction unless they have a clear set of policy statements, unless they have a clear set of what commissioners want to see them investigate and pursue. And so I feel when we have those statements, we got to put them to use. And I hope over time, as we explored in our recent hearing on non-compete clauses, about using that Section 5 rulemaking authority to determine whether they need to be restricted.
And that competition rulemaking piece of yours is soon to be published in the pages of some inferior to our own law review, not to be named. But you can Google it also. You okay with a handful of questions?
I would love that.
We can do a couple, and then we're going to go to break. And if you are a student, I will call on you first because I like you more than the other people. I think you get to declare victory.
Great. Well, I just want to thank again you and all your students here. I know we mentioned we've done a few things here, and I really hope that students here can really think about you are so uniquely positioned at this 2020 over the next several years and beyond to really shape such an important part of law, whether it be, you know, at the FTC, whether it be at one of our state attorneys general who are going to keep on flexing their muscles and be a bigger and bigger part of this conversation. And I hope that you're excited about all the ways you'll be able to shape something that's just so important to our economy.
Thank you again for
doing
this.
Thanks again.
Please join me in thanking Commissioner Chopra.